Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
So, legendary New York Yankees Yogi Berra said it best. It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. And he's right, you know, but there's one important exception. And I don't blame Yogi for not thinking of it, because as a talented and a player and coach as he was, Yogi wasn't a copywriter. So he didn't know about the important exception we'll talk about today, showing your prospect a compelling future. Now, not everybody, every copywriter does this, but if you don't, you're missing out on conversions. And even if you do, we're going to talk about a better way to show a compelling future than most people are currently using. And towards the end, Nathan has a couple of really good examples of how to use this in especially lead generation. So we'll get there in a second. As the future awaits, I remind you that copy is powerful. You're responsible for how you use what you hear in this podcast, and most of the time, common sense is all you need. But if you make extreme claims, and if you're writing copy for offers in highly regulated industries like health, finance, and business opportunity, you may want to get a legal review after you write and before you start using your copy. My larger clients do this all the time. So we'll start here. Suppose you're going to sell a pencil or a Sharpie. How do you make this appealing to your prospect? Because deep in the caverns of your prospect's mind, a question looms. What is this writing implement going to do for me? Answer that question right, and you'll increase desire tremendously. And the key to increasing desire and eventually making the sale has very much to do with helping your prospect connect the dots between your offer and their aspirations. And this connecting the dots is not a physical thing. We're not just talking about what the pencil feels like in your hand or the color of the thick black line that comes out of the point of the Sharpie. Connecting the dots in this case has to do with some future event or overall feeling or fantasy, something they want or want to have happen. Because most of the time, that's what people are really buying. Now, to be sure, if the buyer is a purchasing agent for a large organization, he may be looking for technical specs or reliability or price or value, because his future may be based on his skill in making purchases that meet the requirement of the job. But that's not most people. So let's talk about most people. When your copy connects the dots between where they are and where they want to be, then objections fade, resistance goes away, and the chance that you'll make the sale gets better and better. Look at it this way. You're not selling a product. The product is a vehicle, a pathway to some part of the future they want. Maybe it's something they want to get to stop doing. They don't want to do anymore. Maybe it's something they worry about that they don't want to worry about anymore. Maybe it's transformation, something or someone they want to become. And your product is the ticket, or at least part of the solution, to becoming that thing that person wants to become. So you can create those thoughts and feelings in your prospect. If you can do that, they start deciding, at least subconsciously, yeah, this is what I've been looking for. But here's where a lot of copy falls short. It pounds features and benefits, but it doesn't create the conditions that make the prospect most likely to buy. A big mistake people make is trying to argue their way to a sale. Argument might work in a college class or a court of law. Whether it works in personal relationships is a big question mark. Sometimes it's just part of the conversation that keeps people together, and sometimes it's what drives people apart. But in copy, in selling, simply arguing without engaging the emotional brain in the way we've been talking about, that usually creates friction and resistance. Because the underlying message of an argument is, you're wrong and I'm right. And people don't like to spend money after someone has been beating them over the head verbally with messages telling them that they're wrong. I'm not saying arguing never works. I sure as hell wouldn't count on that. But it's much better to help them see themselves in a future they already want or are very likely to want. What say you, Nathan?
I agree with all of that. No argument for me.
All right. Well, good. We're in a very harmonious path. Okay. Let's say this. You know, there is a way to paint a really compelling word picture. In fact, a couple that we're going to talk about. The one way I'm going to talk about has worked from time immemorial and will keep working until the death of the sun, at which time I'm pretty sure everything will stop working. But before we get to that, let's take a horrifying tour of the three ways people usually use that definitely don't work. And the first one we'll call stacking facts. All right. So let's say your extensive and exhaustive research has revealed 7 facts about number 2 pencils. They are: 1, graphite core hardness. The number 2 designation refers to the hardness of the pencil's graphite core, which corresponds to HB on the international scale, a medium level of hardness and darkness. Number 2, standard use in U.S. testing. Number 2 pencils are the standard required type of pencil for filling out Scantron forms in standardized tests, because their graphite marks are dark enough to be detected by optical scanners. Number 3, material composition. Most number 2 pencils have a core made of graphite and clay, encased in wood, and even recycled paper is sometimes used. Number 4, a typical number 2 pencil has a hexagonal barrel and is about 7 inches long when unsharpened, with a diameter of about 7 millimeters. Wake up, everyone. 5, paint and coating. The wood casing is usually painted yellow in the U.S., a tradition that dates back to the 1890s when yellow was used to denote high-quality Chinese graphite. Number 6, eraser attachment. Most number 2 pencils sold in the U.S. come with a pink rubber eraser attached to one end, held by a metal ferrule, often made of aluminum or brass. And number 7, toxic and safe. Modern number 2 pencils are non-toxic. Despite the common myth, they do not contain lead, only graphite, which is a form of carbon and is safe to handle.
David.
Yes.
I feel like you're trying to bore me into buying right now.
That's about it. But if you're still with us, some of those facts, each of those facts, might make a great jumping off point for content. Hey, you could probably even put together a really mediocre, boring listicle called 7 Things You Probably Didn't Know About Number 2 Pencils with that information. Okay, great. What a wizard you are. But if you actually want to sell the pencil, not so much. All right. Our next way not to sell is simply to give a list of features, hoping against hope that your prospect will do the hard mental work of figuring out how those features help him or her get to where they want to be. So let's look at 5 features of a fine point Sharpie. It's designed with a precise, durable tip. It contains fast-drying, alcohol-based permanent ink. It is resistant to water and fading. It comes with a lightweight plastic barrel. It features a snap-on cap. Okay. With this precious information, you are ready to win a trivia contest. But I promise you, I didn't wake up this morning and ask myself, where can I get a pen with a lightweight plastic barrel and a precise, durable tip? And your prospects didn't probably think about that first thing either.
Definitely not.
Okay, number 3, don't think statistics are going to do the job. Check these out. According to the Pencil Manufacturers Association, the standard number 2 pencil contains enough graphite to draw a line about 35 miles long. The Writing Instrument Manufacturers Association reports every year companies produce more than 2 billion pencils, with large portion being number 2 pencils used in schools and offices. According to manufacturing specifications, standard number 2 pencil weighs about 0.2 ounces or 5.7 grams. What would you say to that? I'd say interesting, but not exciting. Translation, no sale. Let me know what you think before we get into the good stuff.
I think that last part would be the least likely to get me to buy, especially if I was a consumer rather than somebody trying to buy for maybe the office.
Okay. Yeah, me too. So let's talk about the best ways. The single best way I've ever found for creating a vision of a compelling future is a persuasion story. Now, many persuasion stories are about the past, like origin stories, or the present, like empathy stories. But there's a particular class of persuasion story that are ready-made for future casting. They're literally called stories that predict the future from my book, The Persuasion Story Code. And one of the best types of stories that predict the future is the unexpected benefit story. You know, there's a famous example from about 200 years ago that shows you how these stories work. Possibly the most persuasive person in the first half of the 19th century in America was Daniel Webster, the attorney, orator, and politician. One of his most fascinating persuasive stories has survived intact into the 21st century, courtesy of Victor Schwab, the author and extraordinary copywriter. What I'm about to share with you from Daniel Webster came via Schwab, and it was not from a political speech. Webster was asked by a New Hampshire friend to run the auction for his farm. And here's the story Webster used to open the auction. "Neighbors, we're not auctioning Tom Brown's good milk cows or 80 acres of fine land or a sturdy home that's seen 20 winters. No, I'm offering you the chance of biting into a red apple with the juicy sap running all over your lips, the smell of new mown hay, clear mountain stream water on your table, the crunch of snow under your feet, and the best neighbors in the world." Legend has it that Webster hadn't even finished his speech before ferocious bidding started. The farm sold for a much higher price than anyone expected. What was so interesting here, Webster didn't just present the offer, the farm up for auction, in typical feature and benefit terms. If he had, he might have said something like, "80 acres, twice as big as any other farm in sight, and the milk from these cows is the very milk the governor demands for his own children." He didn't stop there. He didn't even go there. Instead, he went above and beyond. He pretty much dispensed with the features, cows, land, house, as necessary to mention, but hardly that important, in his first sentence. And then he did something really imaginative, something people gathered at the auction surely had not anticipated. Webster figured out a way to very elegantly describe the future unexpected benefit of living at this farm. Namely, the experiences you would get, at least for people who like cold winters, that would be about as close to heaven on earth as you could imagine. Unexpected benefits have a tremendous power in moving your case forward when you're making an effort to persuade. In fact, it's fair to say that one such benefit can do a lot of the heavy lifting for you, just as it did for Daniel Webster's auction pitch. So let's try an unexpected benefit to help you sell a pencil. You may not think of the ordinary, everyday, yellow number two pencil very much. But as I was preparing this podcast, one of the most famous copywriters in the world, who is a friend of mine, confided that he has started using pencils himself. And believe me, he could use anything he wanted for writing. No limits. At the suggestion of another friend, who I'm also mentoring, a few days ago, I got Lee Child's new book, Reacher, where the international best-selling author tells of how he became the success that he is. On page one of his memoir, Lee Child writes, "On Friday, September 2nd, 1994, I went to a stationery chain in the Arndale Center, Manchester, and bought 3 pads of paper, a pencil sharpener, and an eraser. I took them home, which was then in Kirkby Lonsdale, Cumbria, England, more than 70 miles away. On Monday, September 5th, 1994, at home, at the dining room table, I sat down to write. An hour later, I gave the first chapter to my wife. I asked, should I continue? Yes, she said, I like it. That's how Lee Child's memoir begins. 31 years ago, after his date with a pencil and a pad of paper, his worldwide book sales have totaled more than 200 million. So if you're wondering what kind of writing implements some of the world's most successful writers gravitate to, there's your answer. It's a pencil. And unlike a pen, which can run out of ink or explode in your pocket, a pencil can write 4,500 words without stopping. All you need is a pocket-sized pencil sharpener, which you can get for a dollar or so. A pencil. Yes, a pencil. It lets you keep writing even when the Wi-Fi goes out. Much better than a long laundry list of facts, features, or statistics, don't you think?
Yeah. So I've got a question real quick to interject. It seems like a lot of this is not just painting a picture of the future, but painting a picture of, painting a really vivid picture of the future that they want, and not relying on them to do the work of purchasing this equals future that I want, but explicitly laying out, hey, this is what your future is going to look like when you get this thing.
Yeah, let me walk through my process of putting this particular story together. So the first key to making these stories work is having people in them. Not necessarily the prospect, but maybe someone the prospect looks up to or can identify with or would like to be, you know, the famous copywriter is my friend, the best-selling author, Lee Child, my friend and client who recommended Lee Child's memoir to me, and of course myself. It may sound a little trite and obvious for me to mention that stories need people, but I've noticed a lot of stories and copy focus too much on the products and not enough on the people who use them. And the second thing is coming up with the unexpected benefits. And I think this gets to what you're talking about, Nathan. You don't have to get them to imagine what it's going to be like for them. You spell out the benefit. This is what some of the greatest writers in the world use, you know. Of course, there's an implied benefit that you'll become a great writer if you use a pencil. No guarantee, right? But I think if by now you know that's only part of the formula, but the story is appealing in that way anyhow. And then there's the unexpected benefit of never running out of ink or Wi-Fi. Like if you're writing on Google Docs, well, you need Wi-Fi for that. I often do that myself. I don't run out of Wi-Fi too often, but it has happened. So most important of all, this story sets the tone and invites curiosity in the reader then to learn a little more about facts, features, and benefits of this wonderful thing called the pencil. And that tone or context, setting the stage like that, may be the most important thing of all from a sales point of view.
Yeah, I notice on a lot of packaging copy, we put on the front of the product all of the amazing transformations, the future pacing, the what it's going to look like when you get it. And then on the back of the package, after we've sold them on the story, then we add, graphite and hexagonal and all of that stuff, but never lead with that.
Yeah, exactly. Because people want a story. They want a narrative. We need that. So that's one kind of story that predicts the future, the unexpected future benefit. Another kind of story that predicts the future is the improved status story. So a long time ago, a few years ago, I was watching a TV show where cops were observing stylishly dressed people interacting with each other at a fancy party. And one cop sneers to the other, "In there, everyone is constantly measuring everyone else's worth against their own." As a viewer, this scene really made me root for the just folks cops and hate the superficial rich people at the party. But as an observer of human nature, I thought about this for a while, and I decided the cop who made the sneering remark was actually pointing out what goes on whenever two or more people get together, including, by the way, both of those cops. Actually, there was nothing particularly insightful about his comment, even though it did add great dramatic tension at that point in the plot of this particular show. Fact is, we all measure our status against that of others all the time, and not always consciously either, primarily because we are often taught by teachers and religious leaders that we shouldn't, so we fight the urge. You know, John Wooden, the famous UCLA basketball coach, who was called the greatest coach of them all by Sports Illustrated magazine, he said in a TED Talk that the best path to success was not to compare yourself to others. The best path was only to be the best that you could be. And many other experts agree with Wooden. It's great advice. There's only one problem. It's not what people do. Regardless of the advice, we constantly compare ourselves to others. And we have the status stuff. I mean, you know, here's the guy who Sports Illustrated called the greatest coach of all. Well, he has the luxury of not having to compare himself to others because Sports Illustrated said there's no comparison. He's the best, right? But, you know, in the rest of life, we have Nobel Prize winners, and then we have all the lesser mortals. Baseball has its major leaguers, like the late, great Yogi Berra. And they count for more in sports conversations and even at the opening of Copywriters Podcast than baseball players in the one-step lower AAA leagues, some of whom are really good baseball players. Hollywood has its A-listers, and you read about those people on the gossip sites and see them more often than not in the blockbuster movies. We seem to pretend that aside from superstars like Nobel Prize winners and Hollywood A-listers, everyone else is equal. As Stevie Wonder sings, no one is better than I, and I know I'm just an average guy. Most people don't like to admit that they constantly measure the worth of others and conclude that they are either superior or inferior to other people. Unfortunately, there's something in the human brain that is constantly preoccupied with status. Seems it can't be trained out of us. There's even a phrase for this phenomenon at the everyday level: keeping up with the Joneses. And when it comes to persuasion, it's important to note, regardless of how we're supposed to think and believe, people do respond eagerly to offers to improve their status, whether it's fancy cars, degrees from prestigious schools, or expensive watches, or simply by being recognized as employee of the month. We all crave recognition and the opportunity to rank higher in how we are regarded by others. As far as copy goes, there's a story that really appeals to this human urge called the improved status story. Let's do one for Sharpie. If you're leading a team meeting, what commands respect for you from the team? Obviously, your presence and command of the situation. A strong and vibrant leader automatically gets looked up to. But you know what else? The pen in your hand. Sure, you could use a Bic or an expensive Cross pen or even a Mont Blanc pen, which could run into the thousands of dollars. But one pen spells out power like nothing else, the Sharpie. Now, of course, you see the president signing his famous executive orders with a black Sharpie. But if you notice, two news anchors on a cable channel that is not on the same political side as the president, each of them making more than $1 million a year, both of them use Sharpies too. Why? It might have something to do with the respect they know how to command. Of course, you don't have to be in the public arena to use a Sharpie. But when you do, what you'll find is people take you just a little bit more seriously. So that's the improved status story. A little over the top, but as you can see how the use of story, it makes a product more desirable. Okay, we're going to stop there. Nathan, your comments, and then I know you had a couple of great things to say about future pacing and lead magnets.
Yeah, so first of all, I want to bring up, you said that coach from earlier saying, don't compare yourself to others, but then you said, but look, it's just what people actually do. I think one hard lesson of copywriting for me was people aren't always the way we wish that they were, but we have to work with how they are, not how we wish that they were. So,
you might not
be happy that people are driven by status and comparing themselves to others. It may not be the ideal, but it is the way that people are. And so it's our job to understand that and work with it rather than fight against it.
Yeah, so true. I mean, you know, if you're an idealist and you start writing copy and then you start actually paying attention to what gets results, it can deflate your balloon a little bit. You know?
Yeah, it is what it is. I was going to actually ask you a question. So future pacing, all the examples you gave today were a bright future. Here's how awesome the future can get. And I often use the opposite. Sometimes I'll paint a picture of how bad things can get before I paint the picture of how good things can get. Just rub some salt in the wound. Also, I've noticed in lead generation and audience growing, content and lead magnets, the warmer the audience is, the future pacing of a bright future tends to land better. Once they already trust me, they're more likely to get my three tips on how to get the best results from X. But if they don't trust me yet, if they're not warm, if they're not familiar with my offer or with me or my client, the opposite works better. Here's three things you have to watch out for, three big mistakes everybody makes when they're first getting started, and the disastrous results that you can avoid by getting this lead magnet or by watching this video. So I wanted to get your take on the opposite of future pacing that we talked about today, which is future pacing, how bad things can get if you don't take the appropriate action, if you don't buy product, if you don't watch video or listen to podcast.
So I'm an incurable optimist. I know it. And so I'm naturally going to focus on a brighter future, but I'm also a realist. And I know that life doesn't always go the way we plan, and it won't always go the way we plan. I think it's really interesting that you've done some tracking on this and that you've found once they know you, they're interested in the positivity. Until they don't know you, they're more motivated by the negativity. I think that might be because, you know, we're tribal people. And even if you don't have a community, and I know you actually do, you know, you have your cultish marketing, cultish something. Cultish content group. I think they feel like they're in your tribe once they're warmer. And it's also, you know, it's like meeting people where they are. When they're a cold audience, there's a lot of empty space between you and them, which is cold. Empty space is cold. And fear and suspicion and doom casting are also from a, you know, cold emotional temperature. When they know you, they trust you, they're in your tribe, they're believing in you, they're believing in your chance to make their life better or your chance to protect them. Yeah, then they're gonna be warmer and emotionally. And so they'll be more receptive to warm messages.
I think the type of examples that we talked about today were a promise to lead someone to the promised land. And that will work if someone trusts you, they know you, they're familiar with you, they're familiar with your product. The promise to help you escape the whatever. There's a rumbling in the bushes. It might be a tiger. Oh my gosh, I see these bright yellow eyes. Quick, follow me. Let's get out of here. I don't have to trust you that much. I just need to see the rumbling in the bushes, and I'm going to follow your lead. So I think that might be part of it, and it might be something to consider when you're writing your copy. Are you writing for a warmer audience? Are you writing for a brand new, colder audience? And which type of future pacing, maybe experiment, do some A-B testing and see which type of future pacing works better.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, you just got to always pay attention. I mean, it always goes back to meeting people where they are, even with the promises and the future casting that you do. Yeah, so last thing I'm going to say, especially these brighter future stories for warmer audiences, if you like the ones, they come out of this book, The Persuasion Story Code. And we went over two types today, the predicted future benefit and the improved status story. There are 23 other types in the book too. And I'll show you how to write them, give other examples. So check that book out.
Little bit of status signaling. Amazon bestseller from the world's greatest copywriting coach.
There you go. Yeah, so that's why you should do it.
All right. I will make sure to include a link to the Persuasion Story Code in the show notes for today's episode. You can get the show notes over at copywriterspodcast.com. And until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later. Hey, if you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app so we can get into ears of more listeners. Thank you.